Good afternoon. Please be seated. Actually, good late morning rather than afternoon. Our third case today is case number 60071, in re the parental rights, Esther Garber. Ms. Hubbard for the appellant, Mr. Friedman for the respondent. Ms. Hubbard.
Good morning, Chief Judge and Justices. My name is Janice Hubbard. I'm a Deputy District Attorney representing the Department of Social Services, the appellant in this matter, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may.
Certainly.
This is an appeal from a district court judgment denying a petition to terminate parental rights. In the Juvenile Dependency Court, that court ordered Mr. Garber to complete drug testing, to take drug treatment, and other orders.
Did the department ever get jurisdiction to require that in the first place?
NRS 432B.560 states that the court may order the parents, guardians, or the child into treatment in the best interest of the child. The orders that he be in drug treatment and take drug tests and those other orders are significant, as it's the noncompliance with those orders that led to the petition to terminate parental rights that was filed 18 months later.
So failure to follow a case plan becomes a basis upon which one can terminate parental rights.
Well, the failure to become a fit parent, to complete treatment for the court to be able to find them to be fit for appropriate placement, that is what is important.
This is a non-offending parent.
Correct. This is a parent that did not have a 432B finding of fault against them. 432B.330 only lists certain categories where fault can be found. It's abuse, abandonment, neglect, unavailability due to incarceration, and a few other very specific.
None of which apply to this particular individual.
Correct, because the child was not removed from him. The child was removed from the mother, who was negligent and who did submit to a 432B.330 finding of negligence and was found to be negligent, and Amy was found to be a child in need of protection. And when the court finds that child in need of protection, then the court can order under 432B.560 orders that flow from that needing of protection so that the child can reunify with a parent.
But when you have a non-offending parent, why wouldn't it be more prudent for you to have to go through the process of finding that parent at fault?
There are 432B.330.
There's no notice? There
is notice. They are noticed. They are at the protected custody hearing.
Not that they're at fault or that there's any basis to have the child removed.
It's not. Because the court, 432B is not looking at the fault of the parents. 432B is looking at the best interest of the child.
But counsel, you used a word of art. You said reunification.
Correct.
The non-offending parent has never been ununified from the child.
It is once the court, I agree with the court, a parent has a right to parent unless there's a court judicial steps in between before whatever reason.
But specifically, we were in a situation where because of the action of one parent, we have this legal fiction of non-unification. But as to the other parent, we never went that way. So how do we place on the back this 432 massive presumption, which was designed for someone who had been ununified?
At the time, if I understand your question correctly, at the time that Amy came into the custody of the Department of Social Services and the court found that she was a child in need of protection, Mr. Garber could not be a placement option for several reasons, including that he had a temporary protection order against him that found that
was temporary.
And it was dissolved subsequently. So it
was subsequently dissolved. But at the time it was dissolved, the Juvenile Dependency Court reviewed Mr. Garber at that time and said, based on your recent DUI, based upon the bar fight, based upon your positive drug testing screen and your non-visiting with the child, or your very few visits with the child, the court found that he needed to enter into treatment and that Amy was still a child in need of protection. 432B.330 looks at the circumstances of which a child needs protection. It doesn't look at specifically the fault of parent or parents. It gives the basis for the court finding that the child needs protection, but it's not looking at both parents. It's how we look at the statute. Did I answer your question?
You did. And again, with the aspect of the TRO, it makes it a little more interesting your argument, but absent the TRO, I still have trouble with the fact that you've got a non-offending parent that you can initiate this type of a proceeding.
Historically, what the courts do is that social services get called to an event. One parent is something that caused the department to be called usually. They look instantly at the other parent, and so does the court. And if the court finds that the other parent is fit and proper, and no legal case is ever started, the court would, and then the department looks at the other parent and hands the child over. If the department has some concerns, they bring those concerns to the juvenile dependency case, and that begins the legal case, at which point at the protective custody hearing, the court has to make an analysis of what the department did and agree or disagree and find that the child is in need of protection or not in need of protection. If the child is not in need of protection, then the child is placed back with a parent.
But a child...
Wouldn't go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Wouldn't the fact that you didn't have any place to place the child because of the TRO, wouldn't that be your most compelling argument? And wouldn't that be a basis for starting a separate proceeding?
Correct. That was...
Against the non-offending...
That was... But it took him several months to get the temporary protection order dissolved, or it became a protection order, not just a temporary, it became an extended one. That was not dissolved until August. The child was placed with the department in May. During that time period...
It's entirely his, it's his obligation to make sure that that gets dissolved and resolved.
Because it has a no contact provision in it.
Right.
But Ms. Hubbard.
Yes.
The no contact provision initially applied to Rachel and the child, but the no-contact provision as to the child was withdrawn.
That did not happen until July or so, approximately in July. At that time, the court, juvenile dependency court, did review the facts as they applied to Mr. Garber at that time and found that the drug testing was positive, the DUI, the bar.
Had the child in need of protection determination been made?
Yes, it has to be made within 72 hours of removal. So, yes, back on May 14th, when that child was removed, it had to be brought to the court. And then in this case, it was continued once more. But, yes, that initial finding that the child was in need of protection was made back in May, and that's what gave the department custody of the child.
Right. But a key fact on which that determination was made changed. Which was the, let me just finish my question, if I may, which was the TPO limitation on the contact with the child.
Correct. At which time?
Was there a new assessment?
Yes. The juvenile dependency court did do a new assessment at that time, right in around those times.
When the new assessment was made,
yes.
What then became the basis for a child in need of protection?
What the juvenile dependency court found was that Mr. Garber had tested positive for methamphetamine. He had a recent DUI. He had not been visiting the child very often. He had visited 3 times in 3 months, I believe the court found. And those were the reasons that the court was, and the allegations of domestic violence, the court ordered him to comply with the case plan and found that Amy was still a child in need of protection. And testimony was provided by Mr. Garber and his counsel. He had counsel throughout this whole period.
And he didn't contest that determination?
There was a hearing on it. There was testimony provided. He did not appeal that order, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Counsel, are you suggesting, am I following your argument correctly, that although the initial allegation which gives rise to the characterization of a child in need of protection is not against a parent, when we are in the process of finding an appropriate placement for that child and a natural parent becomes available, but out of an abundance of caution and in support of her position in this case, that this child continues to need protection, the judge simply says, you need to do A, B, C, and D. Are you suggesting that a child, once determined to be a child in need of protection, can never become reunited with a natural parent who cleans up, if you will, by the way, who did not give rise to that allegation in the first place, or once a child in need of protection, once a parent who isn't clean, never shall the two become reunited again?
we have cases all the time where parents do get cleaned up, they do complete their case plans, they work at the Department of Social Services, they show the court that they are fit parents,
and
they are reunited.
And they've also always been the offending parent, correct?
I'm sorry, what?
They have also always been the offending parent.
Not always, no. We have both sides come into the court. We have both mother and father appear at court at almost all proceedings. Both are offered case plans under 432B560, which states, you know, parent, guardian, or child shall enter into treatment. And both parents are given the opportunity for reunification. Our primary goal is the parent that we remove from, we try and reunite with first, so that we don't enter into the custody issues. However, our goal is to reunite that child with a parent, and both parents are equally available, and both parents do complete reunification in our cases.
So once the judge in this case found that the non-offending parent was at least a safe placement, the child is no longer in need of protection, that's really the ruling that you're appealing, isn't it?
Correct. She never did find that, though. The juvenile dependency court never did find that Mr. Garber was a safe place for placement. And that is the order that Judge Schumacher did not follow, because she found that the court could not order him into treatment. She added the requirement under 432B560 that he be an offending parent. That does not fall within the statute. The legislature didn't construct it that way. They didn't make the requirement that they both be offending parents to get into treatment. And it doesn't flow with the wording of the statute. 432B560 simply states that the court can order a parent, child, or guardian in the best interest of the child into treatment. A 432B330 finding inserted into that wouldn't make sense, because a child can never have a 432B330 finding. So making that requirement part of the group but not to the entire group doesn't flow within the legislative intent. The intent, I believe, was that the court can order the parents to be into treatment to become fit and proper. We have cases all the time where we have a mother comes in, she identifies four or five possible fathers, we DNA test, we find out who the true father is, and then we begin a case plan with that parent to get them fit and proper. If they are already fit and proper, then placement can be with them once they've developed a bond. Otherwise, we begin treatment with them so that they can become fit for reunification. Our goal is reunification with the child, with the parent, with either one of them. Did I answer your
question? But, counsel,
yes.
You look at the federal standpoint of fundamental right of a parent who has not been disunified, the term of art again. What do we do with that? The fundamental right of this parent.
Correct, Your Honor. It is a right to parent until you have that court finding that steps in and says, this is a child in need of protection. Similar to criminal juvenile cases. In criminal juvenile cases,
this is not a criminal juvenile case.
Correct.
We are under a civil ambit, and we have a very strict scrutiny to approach and apply in this.
Correct.
And we're just bouncing over it like it's not even there. And that's bothersome. It's a concern.
We are hopefully not bouncing over anything. We are going before the court to get judicial review, and the court finding
the Supreme Court
that this
uses
child
the term
is in need of
fundamental parenting. Right. It makes me stand up and question.
It is a right to parent. There's no, and I agree with the court there.
And additionally,
however,
when we start with, there's been no deunification, so why are we trying to reunify where it's never been separated? That's the real crux of the problem I'm having. We have a non-offending parent, so nothing has ever been done to separate them from this child.
However, that non-offending parent was unavailable for a variety of reasons, and then when he did become available and the court looked at him, then the court found there were issues.
That's where I need some clarification.
Yes.
What I'm trying to understand now is there was this TPO in place. The hearing that took place on June 22nd, okay, and this one we're making these determinations, there was undisputed testimony that the TPO did not apply to the child.
After
so at that point, why didn't this all just become moot? Because that, you know, you had acknowledged that the TPO was the basis for your having concerns over this child's placement.
When a parent becomes available, then the department and the courts look at this parent to see if he is fit and proper. We have, the department now has custody of a child, so they have legal responsibility for that child. They can't just blindly turn a child over to a parent. We have parents in our cases that are unfit for a variety of reasons, mental health reasons, whatever. We look at them initially in the court. The court has their own standard, but the court and the department look at them, and we present it to the court, and the court says whether they are fit for placement to take legal custody from the department to say this child is no longer in need of protection and placed with the father. Does that answer your question, that there was judicial review?
No, because no longer in need of protection from the other parent, not the non-offending parent.
But the temporary protection order...
Once you lose the basis for...
The temporary protection order was only one part of the analysis. There was also the domestic violence that went behind it,
right.
The drug analysis, the drug testing.
Ms. Hubbard, I'll give you your 2 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Friedman, I'm going to give you 17 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. If it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Friedman. I represent the father and the respondent in this case. Just to answer one or two questions before I get into my prepared remarks, Your Honor, 432B560 does say that the court may cause a parent to undergo draconian tests. However, it has to be read in context with all the other laws that most of which, if you look at the judge's opinion on page 23, she analyzes this and says that the other statutes say that the parent from whom the child was taken. So you can't just interpret that a parent. It doesn't say both parents. It doesn't say either parent. It says a parent. So when you're trying to interpret who that parent is, you have to look at the other statute, the other part of the statute that continue to say from whom the child was taken.
So in other words, your argument is that another determination under 432B would have to be made as to your client before any of this or most of this would actually be applicable.
I don't know if it would ever be applicable, Your Honor, but I do, in this case, they brought a petition against my client and the mother under the statute, stabbed and found unfit. It said nothing against my client. We moved to dismiss it, and they agreed to dismiss it. It was stipulated, and there was a court order that it was dismissed. So it's irrelevant in this case, but maybe in another case, if they go and find that the parent is one of these parents contemplated by our statute. Not a parent who occasionally does drugs. A parent who is addicted to drugs and consistently uses drugs to the point where he's consistently unable to take care of the child. At the trial, which is the important evidence here, it was never once shown that my client was ever unable to take care of his child, sober or not sober. Never once unable, let alone consistently.
Mr. Friedman, when that was dismissed, that 432 proceeding, as to your client, was it dismissed with any stipulations that he must submit to a case plan or anything else, or was it just outright dismissed?
It was just outright dismissed, Your Honor. Again, the petition had no allegations against my client. We moved to dismiss it. They agreed, and so the court ordered it.
So for purpose of the record, then how do we get him acquiescing to a case plan?
Well, he never did, Your Honor. That's another issue which I'd like to get into if necessary, but I don't think that's necessary if I could go into my prepared remarks. First of all, he was ordered to do these things. Well, if you look at page 23 of the judge's ruling, I believe it is, or maybe that's page 6. The judge says that that order where he was ordered to do this was never signed by the court. She admits that. It was overlooked. It was a master's order. But let me say this. My client did go to court after he had refused to go along with a plan.
Mr. Freeman, if I can interrupt you, that was a master recommendation that was never approved by the court. Then.
That's my recollection.
So there was no order.
There was no real order. It could be argued. But let me say, my client did have to go to court after he refused to abide by the plans. Let me say this. He did take 26 counseling sessions. drug counseling sessions. He did undergo drug counseling, which they requested him to do, and he did undergo domestic violence counseling. Now, they bring up domestic violence. Their own expert was so poor at the hearing that the master said he doesn't have to do domestic violence counseling. It didn't apply to him. What the master was, the expert was holding him guilty for things that he was found not guilty of, for TPOs that were dissolved. And the master herself, the most severe critic of my client, would not order him to go to that kind of testing. But he did go to court, and the district attorney, not Ms. Hubbard, says to him, "You'd do anything to get your child back, wouldn't you? Well, then you'll do this plan, won't you?" And he agreed to do part of the plan, which I said he did accomplish. Your Honor, that's the same as if you want to see your child again, put $1 million under the bridge.
Why don't they have a valid concern that he's testing positive for meth and having a valid concern for the child in that regard? Handing over custody to somebody who's testing positive for meth.
First of all, the test was in his hair. Those tests are good for 90 to more days. I understand that we have concern that people in America do drugs and have children. You know, but our legislature realizes the fundamental right to be with your parents is not interfered with to the millions and tens of millions of people in America who occasionally use recreational drugs. Look at the statute. This is one of my arguments. You can't hold the innocent parent to a higher standard than the guilty parent.
In fact, doesn't the statute require that the use of drug or substance be to the extent that the parent cannot parent? That determination was certainly never made in your case, was it?
Your Honor, it's to the extent that he's consistently unable to parent, and there was never one bit of testimony. You know, he had this child for 2 years before the child was given to the mother for Easter vacation, and then when the child wouldn't be returned to father in accordance with their agreement, he made two complaints to social services. They did nothing. And eventually, when he was trying to get his child back, mom calls him and says, "Come pick up the child." He goes to pick up the child. She hits him over the head with a bottle, gets a TPO against him. And that's the TPO we're talking about. Can false TPOs interfere with your right to have a child? Judge Peck ruled that the TPO should never have been granted initially.
Right, but they certainly wouldn't know that at the time, okay? And the information that they had at the time was that there was a TPO in place, and you have to presume it's valid. I would, you know, I'm not sure that they have the obligation to make the determinations whether it's it was issued in error. I think that would be incumbent upon, in this case, the petitioner.
Yeah.
And there was the allegations of domestic violence. There was the positive drug tests. Why could that not cause them to believe that this was a child in need of protection?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
My client wasn't eligible at that time. He had a TPO against him. He was not considered for placement. By the time he was, they did know.
That's what I'm going back to, that June 22nd hearing. Is that the point where they knew the TPO was no longer in place against the child? Or is it related to the job?
I presume they must have, because the stipulated dismissal against your client was July 29th, 2009.
Right.
So the case against your client was dismissed.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Let me say, if I could, though, I did have a couple of, and I did want to address the question of agree. I just want to say that you have duress, you have undue influence, and you have no consideration, because if an innocent parent, if the court doesn't have a right to take a child from an innocent parent, and they say, "We'll give you your child back if you do certain things," where's the consideration? They're giving him back when they should give it back when he doesn't have anything to do. But let me say the most important point here relating to my client's parental rights. That is that all these other arguments are totally irrelevant to this case. They're very important issues. What can the social services do with an innocent parent if they can't even get a finding against them of unfitness or any wrongdoing? What happened was we had a long trial on this case with many witnesses, all who testified about father. And they also had the complete dependency proceedings there. First of all, my argument would be, On page 25 of the judge's order, these are dispositive findings, which are supported by substantial evidence. The judge finds, one of her last findings, that father has the resources, ability, and desire to care for AG's proper physical and emotional growth and development. These are despite, and on page 23, the judge said, nevertheless, the presumptions, those of 128-109, if it applies to the non-offending parent, has been overcome in this case. And that was based on substantial evidence. These rights cannot be terminated when there's a finding of fitness, when there's a finding that he has the ability, and the finding that he has overcome all these presumptions, the presumption that he only made token efforts to parent, the presumption that he failed parental adjustment, the presumption that he specifically overcame on page 23 is that it's in the best interest of the child to, for there to be a termination. So I would argue, ipso facto, he's shown more than token efforts. Ipso facto, he has not shown failure of parental adjustment, if there was anything to adjust to, since there wasn't. And he overcame the presumption that it's in the best interest of the child to have his parental rights terminated. He overcame that, even if the presumption didn't apply to him. Believe me, we had witness after witness after witness. You have my review of the evidence. There's virtually no review of the evidence below by the appellant, because the evidence was all that my client, for the 2 years he had this child, was a fit parent. When this child had a broken arm at 3.5 months old at the YMCA, yeah, his wife got another TPO, false TPO against him, or the mother did. That was dissolved because it turned out that the child's arm was broken at the YMCA. So who did social services give this child to heal a broken arm of a 3.5-month-old child? To my client, Mr. Garver, and his mother. And they came to their house, and they did all these inspections, and everything was fine. Anytime this man has been, you know, here's the deal. Do we take parents, children away from parents because they don't pass the test of social services, or is the proof of the pudding in how the man takes care of his child?
Well, actually, Mr. Friedman, isn't it even simpler than that? Isn't it true that the state in this case, the division, had a burden to show that it was better that this child go to someone he doesn't know than a loving, willing, and able parent, and that the record in this case shows that they failed to show that? Isn't it just that simple?
It's that simple, because when social service, you know, this child was in perfect health when my client had him. When social services had the child, she had bloody blisters on her feet, she fell down steps and hurt her foot. The person that they want to have this child, the maternal grandmother, testified that once she got the child, 8 months later, the child had 3 severely rotten teeth that needed capped. There were all kinds of injuries to this child, black eyes and things that happen in social services and in foster care. And there was not one proof of any neglect ever of my client when he had the child. You know, they want to apply a test to these parents whose children are taken, but the test is how do they parent, not whether or not they'll do what we tell them. If you look at the statutes, it all has to do with, you know, did the parent neglect the child? Did the parent live with another child who died mysteriously? None of these sections apply to my client. They couldn't find one thing. She was never abused. Let me say this, too. We know how long this case has been going on. We know how aggressive social services is, particularly because I would submit my client has a federal case against the county for the damages that my client has suffered. They haven't been able to find one thing. They have investigative staffs. They have a lot more resources than my client, who paid me $200 for this case by the time we went to court. And they can't find one thing that my client ever did wrong with his child, even though he had her for the 2 years. And, you know, The really killer in this case is that my client's mother was not considered as a suitable alternative for foster care because she had some felony uttering charge before the kid's arm was broken, before she nursed the child back to health. They gave her the child when she had these charges already. She nursed the child back to health. Once again, the proof of the pudding is not in how you take care of your child. It's in allegations and worries about the past. And the main thing, though, it's too bad people in our society do drugs. But the criminal laws don't say if you do drugs, we take your kids away. And the legislature doesn't say that either. The legislature says if you use drugs excessively, and that's the only thing that's relevant here to my client, to the extent that you're consistently unable to take care of the child, then the child is in need of protection. Why should my client be held to a higher standard? And again, I do want to point out that at the 72-hour hearing, incorrect hearsay was presented for the court to make the finding that the child was a child in need of protection. At the 72-hour hearing, it was reported on hearsay that the tribal police said that the mom was incapable of taking care of her kid, that she had a 1.7 or 1.8 alcohol, that the other people with mom were all intoxicated. When the police officer testified at the trial, and, you know, this was found out months later when we brought a federal case and got the police officer's report, you know, this is subject to abuse, this dependency. It's based on hearsay. It's secret. The non-offending parent can't even get the required information within 72 hours. When he testified, he said mom had a 1.4. She was capable of taking care of the child. The other adults hadn't been drinking. There were no drugs, nothing illegal. They had a nice tent. They were at Pyramid Lake. She had sleeping bags. The child was not in need of protection, but social services asked him now to deliver the child to them at a location halfway there. They couldn't go all the way out to investigate it for themselves. Under Wallace v. Spencer, it's required that social services make a reasonable investigation. They just went on double or triple hearsay. And let me, if I just may, this hearsay went through the Washoe County Dispatch to social services. So it's a double hearsay at the point. It's presented to the court before we had a chance to get the police report and to find out what really happened. I didn't represent Mother. Mother didn't know, so she submitted. And may I just say this, too? The justice said that in an abundance of caution. Let me say that when I first started practice, this has sort of been my life's work, keeping children with parents, and thank you for having this session. It's not remunerative, but it's satisfying.
Mr. Friedman, I'd like to ask a question. I realize the court is confined to the record in this case, but since Judge Schumacher's decision was entered in December of last year, what has been the status of the custody of the child?
Your Honor, we brought a motion, first of all, that there not be a termination of parental rights hearing, and there was, and we appealed that, and it's still held. So the fact that I didn't appeal some earlier orders is what I was going to get into. But the child, we brought a motion to return the child to the father. The child's been returned to the father. The child's going to school. The child, at first, the Judge Schumacher ordered that the child visit the grandmother every weekend. So that went on for a period of time till there was a review. At the last review, maybe 2 weeks ago, Judge Schumacher ordered that all proceedings will terminate in 60 days, that social services can still make unannounced visits to my client's house and regular visits. They can still contact the school. They still have legal custody until 60 days when this case will be over, unless my client actually does ever abuse or neglect his child. And the child's going to school. She did miss about 5 days with diarrhea, but She's glad to be with her father. She cries when she has to go to her grandmother, which has been reduced. She's always known that her father is her father. When anything happened to her bad in social services, she would report it to her father, and he would report it to social services and get no response. When her grandmother was mistreating her, she would report, or not mistreating her, but when she didn't like what was happening there, she was...
Since December 30th, 2011, there have been how many review hearings with the judge?
Well, I know that...
Or the master.
In front of the master?
The master and the judge.
Let me say that the judge took this case away from the master due to the fact that limited resources, why go to the master and have to appeal to the judge when they had different...
So all of the review hearings have been with the judge?
With the judge, and I believe... I don't
approximately.
Know, at least two.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Friedman.
Ms. Hunt, you have 2 minutes.
Justice Hardesty, I've confirmed there have been three. Ms. Testa is here, and she's in the court.
Before you get too far underway, Mr. Friedman pointed to the record, pages 23 and 25, and two fairly critical factual findings by the district court judge. One, if the presumption applies to a non-offending parent, it's been overcome by Mr. Garver, as discussed below in this case. And then on page 25, it says the evidence presented establishes that Mr. Garver has the resources, ability, and desire to care for this child. Why doesn't that become factual findings to which we're required to defer, wholly independent of all the other arguments? I mean, our standard of review is extremely deferential, and there is evidence to support those findings.
Because Judge Schumacher relied on the fact that she found that NRS 432B560 required that there be a fault finding made against Mr. Garver prior to him being ordered into treatment. And since you can't order into treatment and drug testing could not be part of that. And so she disregarded that information when she was making her decisions. She found that 432B330 fault finding was the overwhelming concern. She focused in on a right of a parent to parent and not on the court's finding that this is a child in need of protection and that the orders flow from the needing to protect that child.
Counsel, in that vein, on page 15 of the court's order, Judge Schumacher indicated that WCDSS did not allege or show that Mr. Garver at any point before or after the dependency case commenced abused or neglected Amy. The harm done to a child by an offending parent cannot be imputed. But the critical language was, at no time did he abuse or neglect the child. I understand you're the advocate of the agency, and I understand you're advocating the agency's interest. But we're talking about the termination of a child from a parent who the record says did no harm to that child before or after. Shouldn't the court give that some weight? And isn't the trial court judge allowed to look at that and make that, when we're talking ultimately termination?
I agree, and I believe the court did give that weight. However, as you heard, Mr. Garver did not have custody of Amy for the two prior months prior to the placement of.
The court
so he
said
did not
before
have,
and after.
Correct.
The father never did anything that harmed the child. And we're going to terminate this fundamental right when harm was never done?
Your Honor, the child was 2 years old at the time that she came into the custody of the Department of Social Services. At the time, the court found the child was in need of protection and that Mr. Garver needed
as
complete treatment.
As to the mother.
Correct. And
but not the father, because they dismissed that process. Is that not correct?
Correct. It doesn't require fault finding as to both, and you have to basically have custody to have a fault finding, because you have not actively abused or neglected that child if that child's not in your custody. He had not had custody of that child for the 2 months preceding, as you had just heard from Mr. Friedman. So you've got an issue there where you've got one parent that is parenting, and we are removing from the parent that is parenting, and the other parent has not been actively involved.
Parenting is a very interesting term, counsel, in terms of what parenting is these days. especially when you have a parent in the relationship and one who's slightly removed because of various court orders or other difficulties between the two people. But I still come back to this one critical finding the court made. We have a parent who did nothing to the child. And ultimately, we're going to place this death penalty sanction on this parent of taking the child away forever.
But we did offer services. We offered him a plan by which he could reunify. And we do have parents.
And, that's an interesting sub-point of...
We have the same issue with DNA fathers. Should
you even be involved in that?
Ms. Hubbard, I'm sorry. Were you finished making your point?
Well, we also have the issue with DNA fathers, fathers that come along and are subsequently identified as the father. Once the court has jurisdiction over that child, they have to make sure that parent is proper for placement.
But you're talking about a unification. Where that parent had not, possibly except for the mother saying and then the DNA, been involved.
Correct.
This situation, that's not the issue. We have a unique set of facts we're dealing with in this particular case. So, as was argued earlier, we have apples and oranges.
But this ruling affects every case in Washoe County because it affects every...
And it possibly should because we're talking about...
Parental rights, correct.
Parental rights, but the non-offending party.
Or whether the court, because the child is in need of protection, whether the court can find... Because that child needs protection, the order needs protection
based upon the record and the facts, which Judge Schumacher says was never shown on the record, as to this parent.
The juvenile dependency court found that he was not a fit parent, and the court did, Schumacher did not give credit to those orders.
But they dismissed the hearing where they charged him with being an unfit parent. They just made an assumption because there was never a proper hearing.
There actually was a hearing where testimony was provided. There were actually several hearings where testimony was
provided. But where he was charged with being an unfit parent. They dismissed that. Is that not correct?
They dismissed the petition as to Mr. Garber. Okay. Correct. However, there were numerous placement hearings and numerous hearings where he was provided the opportunity to show that Amy was no longer in need of protection. And the court found in each case that Amy was in need of protection, and those orders were upheld by the district court, and the orders that he comply with the case plan
and
were
fundamentally
upheld
was he
court.
Entitled to a de novo hearing when this termination of parental rights action was formally brought?
I'm sorry, was he what?
Was he entitled to a brand new hearing when the official termination of parental rights action was brought against him as to this child?
Yes, if I understand your question correctly, the juvenile dependency court was still having hearings every 6 months or as more frequently requested by the parties. They have to have hearings every 6 months. The termination of parental rights is a separate case, and the juvenile dependency court still has their hearings. If the juvenile dependency court had found that Amy was no longer in need of protection, that Mr. Garber was appropriate, they would have placed with...
And counsel, even though the court made a... accepted the fact that he allegedly had some drug issues, did they not make, as I said, this finding that at no time did he abuse or neglect the child?
Your Honor, that child...
Did she not say that in her order?
She did, Your Honor, but...
And ultimately, does the judge not weigh these things to reach the conclusion?
When he broke into Ms. LaPrairie's home and the...
Counsel, that was not
there
the
was
question.
No drug testing, but there was a subsequent test that showed that he was positive.
And counsel, if you're talking about the break-in and all that, that order, as my colleagues have talked about, was thrown away. The court said this temporary restraining that gave predicate to was gone. It was dismissed. It had no bearing. It had no bearing as to his relationship, again, to the child.
We did present that testimony, though, in the termination of parental rights case.
And
there was a witness and Ms.
And did the court consider it?
Yes.
Ms. Hubbard, can
yes.
I ask a question, Chief?
Sure, absolutely.
I've been trying to sort out the procedural effect Child Protective Services or Social Services Department's decision to dismiss the petition against Corey. once the dismissal has occurred, then the only basis under which he's involved at all is the CHIN order, correct?
Yeah, that the child is in need of protection, yes.
Uh-huh. So if the determination of that child's need is based upon the relationship of the child to Rachel, not to him, I mean, he hasn't been brought into court. The case has been dismissed. What's the basis for him to have to submit to case plans and lots of stuff?
The court makes the,
because there's been
it's
no,
the finding by the court that this child needs protection and that the parents need to do services to become appropriate and fit parents. 432B560 doesn't limit it to or differentiate between the types of parents. It states that the parents, the court can order the parents into treatment, guardian and the child, into treatment so that in the best interest of the child. It's that court finding that the child is in need of protection and that the parents are inappropriate for whatever reason.
So,
but I don't believe the court's, the focus is not on fault of the parents by 432B. The focus is on protecting the child.
Right. And my question then leads to this. Are there other cases in which you have sought and obtained termination of parental rights where the predicate for all of this was a CHIN order?
Yes, Your Honor. Prior to this case, we were on a frequent basis only having a fault finding against one parent, because in this day and age, only one parent usually has custody of the child. Okay. Whichever parent we removed from, we got the 432B330 finding of fault. The child was in need of protection, and then the orders flowed from there, including the termination of parental rights case flowed from there. But not if
you had a frequent one. What about in circumstances in which the parents had joint custody and only one created the circumstances for a CHIN order?
It was once the court found the child was in need of protection, the drug testing would cause the court's order to comply with drug treatment and testing as required.
Even as to the non-offending parent?
Yes. That was how we handled cases traditionally.
And you have sought then later termination of parental rights derived from that process?
Since this order, we have been kind of trying to work very hard and stretching the statutes of 432B330 to cover both parents, although we can't at times. We are still having cases where we have one finding only against one parent because there is only available one finding. Mm-hmm. I mean, one parent. So another case has not gone to trial on that issue since the Garber case, but they will be coming down the road.
So the final question I have is, how does the district or how does social services approach the Troxel rights with respect to the non-offending parent?
If I understand your the case plan is reviewed by the juvenile dependency court, and the juvenile dependency court finds that that case plan is appropriate and then orders the parent to comply with it. It is filed with the district court. It is filed in the court file, and it is attached to all court reports for every six-month hearing.
Right, but all of this derives from a best interest determination as opposed to what Troxel seems to suggest. If you're a non-offending parent, you don't have to submit to any of this stuff. I'm a fit parent. I have a right to my kid. Give me my kid.
You do have a right to parent until the court makes that finding that this child is in need of protection. Mm-hmm. And then once that court makes that finding, then the court also needs to find later that a parent, that the child is no longer in need of protection. And when the court has to make that second step of finding that the child is no longer in need of protection, then clearly it's found an appropriate parent or appropriate placement.
Thank you, Chief.
I think I have enough information. I'm okay. Thank you.
Mr. Friedman, thank you for your arguments in this matter. I know that we can't. Sorry. It was very challenging for us, and thank you for your arguments. This matter stands submitted.
All right.